Labor and Commerce will now come to order. It's 3:22 on April 9th. With us, we have Representative Thompson, Sadler, Miller, Holmes, and myself, Chair Olson. We do have a quorum to conduct business. We expect at least one more member to join us momentarily. Please turn off your cell phones or Blackberries. And I think we're going to take up where we left off. First bill is House Bill 326. This bill is work in progress, and we're going to be holding it over. We anticipate that we'll have some real good news by the middle of the week on this bill. We were hoping to have it by late this afternoon, but it didn't quite all come together. But we'll be holding this bill over, and I think the sponsor of the bill is going to be real happy with the outcome. Second bill on the calendar today is House Bill 202, Sales of Food by Producers to Consumers. I see the sponsor of the bill sitting in the room. Would you care to join us and give us a brief recap of the bill?
No food today, I guess.
I know.
Welcome back.
That's good. It's my snack.
Representative Wilson, no props today.
I got my one shot, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Tammy Wilson, District 11 representative. Before you'll see a substantially different bill on 202, and so it's been changed, which now disallows any food product that has any animal origins, raw or heat-treated products. This eliminates meats, seafood, and dairy products. We went a step further to disallow food products that require time or temperature controls to keep food safe for human consumption from being sold by a producer. We narrowed our focus by addressing samples and listing food products that may be sold. What we really did, Mr. Chairman, is that we tried to take the regulations as we believe they were going to be changed. Our whole point for today is not necessarily to move this bill, but to make a point that we want the regulations out before the farmers market start so that they can prepare for it. As we did a little bit more research, and you have it with you, you'll notice that in April, which this month, some of the farmers markets are already opening, and so I guess on the record, I'd love to hear from DEC when they plan on getting the regulations out.
We can hear from them sooner than that. Any questions for Representative Wilson before we go on to Kristen Ryan? Seeing none, Kristen, are you with us?
Hi, Mr. Chairman. Yes, I'm with you.
Welcome back, and can you give us a status on the what's going on with the new regs that you mentioned during the last hearing?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I'd be happy to. For the record, my name is Kristen Ryan. I'm the director for the Division of Environmental Health in the Department of Environmental Conservation. The amendments to the Alaska Food Code, which is 18 AEC 31, are at the Department of Law for the final review with Steve Weaver, who's the regulations attorney that I guess is the final step at the Department of Law to review them. I've had several, at least five conversations today with them about these regulations, so I know they're working on them, and that's about all I can say. I can't say when they'll be done, but they're deep in them, and I'm answering their questions as quick as I can.
Can you give us the best guess? Will they be done by this season?
Yeah, I my guess would be yes, Mr. Chairman. I'm assuming that Steve will be done with them in this week, and then they will go over to the Lieutenant Governor's office, assuming that they get signed off on by the Commissioner after the Department of Law is done. But that's usually a technical step. There's really not any discussion at that point. And then they have to sit at the Department or the Lieutenant Governor's office for 30 days per state law. So, but they'll be finalized at that point and available for the public to review, which allows us time to create pamphlets and brochures with the Cooperative Extension of Alaska and how to interpret them and what they mean and what the changes will mean to the people that want to sell these products. So that month will be used to prepare people for what to expect, but they aren't actually official law until after they've sat at the Lieutenant Governor's office for 30 days.
I think Representative Wilson would like to ask a question.
Well, Mr. Chair, I just want to make sure that people realize that we will hold our own bill. and we will talk to the farmers market folks during the interim. Our biggest concern was we went through these last year. We want to make sure there's time for people to actually be able to utilize these. And my only question is, will people have any kind of fines or anything that will happen to them as these are new, hopefully more friendly ones, but what's your process as far as educating those throughout this next season?
Kristen?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Wilson, as I mentioned, we've already, you know, based on the draft that we're working with, although it's changing through Department of Law's review, but we know the general concepts. We are already working with a cooperative extension of Alaska at the University of Fairbanks to come up with pamphlets and brochures that explain the cottage food industry, what you can sell, how you can do it, without permits, what you need a permit to do, where the test kitchens are, if you want to do an activity that requires a permit, all those sorts of things that the cooperative extension is so good at doing. They truly are the outreach arm when it comes to food preparedness. So we've already established that relationship and are working with them. And as I said, as soon as they become official regulations and are signed by the Lieutenant Governor, we'll be able to publicize them and talk about them while they sit there for those 30 days of time that they're required to.
Thank you, sir.
Kristen, you can't see Representative Wilson, but she is smiling.
I'm watching.
You're watching.
Any questions for either Kristen or Representative Wilson? Seeing none, we will be holding this bill over. And thanks again for 2 years worth of work on this issue.
Thank you for your indulgence, and we'll bring food next time.
No more props.
There's not cookies.
That's right.
Next bill is House Bill 259. Chris, looks like you're it.
Chairman, I'll refer to your committee
aid. Briefly, the committee has a CS that has just been released. The committee is...
Oh, this one. Thank you. I'm so used to having it electronically.
Basically, the committee has not had 24 hours to review it, and we're having a meeting tomorrow afternoon, and at that point in time, we plan on getting it out. But I would entertain a motion to drop adopt the CS as the working document, and that's version E.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd move CS for House Bill number 259, designated 27LS0675-E.
And I'll object for purposes of discussion. Beecha. Conrad will walk us through the difference in the CS.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Conrad Jackson, staff to Representative Olson and the committee. Before the committee, CS version /E was some minor changes from the previous version, version D, trying to take into consideration some comments that we heard from the pharmacy industry and, frankly, from the PBMs to some extent, and I'll just run through those rather quickly. The first change is on page 2. I'm not sure how the best way for you folks to do that would be if you want to look at the original version, version D, that I was working from. But what we did on page 2, lines 6 through 8, we deleted all the material from version D, which deleted the section dealing with the 75 prescription cap and the error rate of 10%. There was concern that on the larger pharmacies that are writing thousands of prescriptions, a 75 prescription audit was just not adequate. And as opposed to going through dealing with statistical analysis and trying to come up with a number on the fly that wasn't going to give them an accurate representation of the pharmacist's activities, we just deemed it simpler to remove that section and address that in future legislation. The next change was on page 2, line 10 through 12. Following submitted, we delete all material. That is the section that deals with unless a longer time period is specified in the contract. What that does is brings us back to the original language of that paragraph that says the audit claim shall occur within 2 years. What we were hearing was there is a possibility of unilateral changes in the contracts that could very quickly go from 2 years that we're specifying here to a very lengthy time frame that totally defeats the purpose of that paragraph. So we've deleted that section of paragraph number four in from version D. The next change is in paragraph 10, which deals with, is on page 2, line 27, which deals with the preliminary audit report delivery time period. We make a change from 60 days to 120 days, and to balance that, we have added a new paragraph that says the interest may not accrue during that time period. So from the time the audit is completed to whenever that preliminary audit report is delivered, no interest will be accruing. That seemed to be a bit of a balance between the pharmacist's concern about interest accruing, while the PBMs, the auditor, were reviewing and developing that preliminary report. The next change inserts a paragraph that was actually in the original bill with some minor changes. We add in a paragraph that reads, to the extent that an audit results in the identification of a clerical. Oh, let me find this. It'll make more sense if I read the actual paragraph. I apologize, Mr. Chairman.
Bottom of page 2 of the new version?
Yes, should be on page 2 of the new version.
Subsection 11?
There it went. Thank you, yep. Representative Holmes. To the extent that an audit finds clerical or record-keeping errors in a required document or record, the pharmacy may not be subject to recoupment unless there is proof of intent to commit fraud or the clerical or record-keeping error results in actual financial harm to an insurer, managed care company, hospital, or medical services corporation, third-party payer, pharmacy benefits manager, or a customer. Again, this goes back to, I believe it was the old paragraph 6 that was deleted from the previous or from the original bill that had to do with Scrivener's errors, a typographical error. It was felt was not, and again, unless it, there was damage occurred, just didn't rise to the level requiring compensation. The next change deals with a new paragraph adding the restriction on confidential information that is obtained during the course of an audit and restricting that from being used for marketing. There was some testimony that pharmacists would have would deal with an audit. Shortly after that, a number of their clients would receive mailings, and they would be soliciting for mail order pharmacies. We felt that this was, I guess for lack of a better term, not quite fair. We've got confidential patient information, and if it is needed to be accessed for the purposes of the audit, that makes complete sense. But if it's used for marketing and picking up new clients, it just didn't seem like the thing to do. The next change inserts a new paragraph limiting subsequent audits to not less than 90 days following an audit.
Representative Sadler.
Pardon me, through the chair. Conrad, could you point out where is that additional section? I just missed the reference to where that mail solicitation.
That is number.
It's the new subsection 19 on page 3.
Gotcha.
There we go. Through the chair, Representative Holmes, if you would continue this, I would certainly appreciate that. I don't have my marked up copy in front of me, unfortunately. The other change that I was beginning to talk about was the limit on 90 days following a previous audit in which no errors had been found. And we go on to describe, to say that errors shall not mean a clerical or record-keeping error. If there are serious errors or there is an attempt to commit fraud, certainly we're not wanting to limit them to that 90-day cap. If there are problems, I think everyone would agree that it only seems reasonable to be able to go back in if the PBM or the auditing company feels it is necessary. The next change would make a change, and the final change would make a change to the effective date to January 1, 2013, as opposed to the fiscal year that was in the previous CS version D. So that puts this bill into effect 6 months earlier. And, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, that is the extent of the changes.
So it's my intent to have everybody digest this tonight, and then we'll bring it back for the committee tomorrow and decide what we're going to do with it. And
Mr. Chairman, if I could add one other thing. I just found a note that is really a policy call and a possible definition change if the members are so inclined. In the back of the bill on section 19B, page 3, line 27, 28, and 29, we deal with the investigation or audit by government agencies. This bill, this section would not apply to those entities. It has been brought up, has not been incorporated, but has been brought up that we may want to consider, you may want to consider, including schools or other government agencies, government entities, municipalities, that type of thing. Only a thought to ponder. And that's all I have, Mr. Chairman.
Any questions for Conrad? I bet we'll have lots by tomorrow. Thanks again, Conrad. And with that, we will hold on to the bill till at least tomorrow, set it aside. Next bill is Senate Bill 122, Real Estate Transfer Fees and Title Insurance. Last week, we again adopted version D, backslash D is the working document. And we have Dana, you hear Dana? Yep, Dana Owen from the sponsor, Senator Egan's office, to give us a brief summary of the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, I'm Dana Owen, staff to the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee. The bill does two important things. It provides that titles researched and issued in the state of Alaska will have at least some anchor to the state, that the person or some people who do these titles and do the research will actually have a physical presence here in the state. And then the other thing that the bill does is it prevents the use of transfer fee covenants, which simply says that that the original seller of a property will reap some kind of a fee additionally in perpetuity as the title changes hands in the future, and that would be outlawed under this bill.
Any questions for Dana? Seeing none, that was brief and concise, and thanks. And are you going to be hanging around for a while?
Oh, absolutely.
With that, the public testimony is open. Is there anybody in the room that cares to testify? Linda Hall shakes her head. Seeing none, people online. Fairbanks, Roger Flotinger. Am I close?
Mr. Chairman?
Yeah, please state your name and affiliation for the record, and I apologize if I butchered it.
Oh, that's fine. My name is Roger Flotinger, and I'm president and owner of Yukon Title Company, Inc. here in Fairbanks.
Well, thank you for joining us today. Please continue.
Although I'm happy to discuss any provisions of this bill, my prepared testimony will be specifically on the residency requirements of Senate Bill 122. The residency requirements are simply an effort to prevent Alaska jobs from being sent overseas. It's nothing more and nothing less. Similar bills have passed in 13 or 14 other state legislatures. You will hear testimony today from a representative of First American Title, a multinational title company that opposes this portion of the bill. It's important to understand that First American currently examines a large percentage of their orders generated in Washington State overseas, where they pay their overseas examiners around 10% of what they pay their local examiners. I receive letters weekly from overseas companies offering to do my title exams in Pakistan or India or the Philippines for a fraction of the amount that it costs me to do the work locally. And that offends me. My examiners receive wages that far exceed the average per capita wage in Fairbanks. My examiners pay local property taxes and contribute to our economy like all the other residents of Alaska. Examiners in the Philippines receive what I personally consider to be slave wages and contribute to nobody but the shareholders of these multinational corporations. And unlike my examiners, these overseas examiners are also not licensed by our Division of Insurance and are not within the reach their reach for review. You will also hear testimony from others that direct operations, those operations that are owned by regional, national, and multinational underwriters, will not be able to open in Alaska or keep their current offices open because of the requirement that they have a limited producer's license. Opponents use this argument to claim that this legislation, if passed, would restrict competition. And I believe that's simply smoke and mirrors. The direct operations that are currently doing business in Alaska, that currently have offices in Alaska, have limited producer licenses. That would not change with this bill. And I would recommend that the committee ask, during this testimony, ask an existing national underwriter if they believe this legislation will impact their ability to have or open offices here in the state. The Alaska Association of Realtors supports this bill as it's written because they know that their clients are better served by local examiners versus somebody from India or Pakistan. The realtors would absolutely fight a bill that restricts competition in our industry because such a bill will adversely impact their clients. This is an Alaska hire issue here, and it's nothing more and it's nothing less. I'm supporting this legislation because I'm in favor of keeping good-paying Alaska jobs here in Alaska. Thanks for the opportunity to testify.
Any questions for Roger? Thanks again for joining us today. Kim Gleason, Ketchikan.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, this is Kim.
Please state your name and affiliation for the record, and thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for allowing me. I'm Kim Gleason, Vice President and General Manager of Alaska Escrow and Title.
Please continue.
Okay, my testimony. I've been in the title and lending industry for 22 years. Alaska Escrow and Title provides title insurance and escrow services to all 7 recording districts in Southeast Alaska. I am in favor of the Bill 122, Section 1 and 2, because I believe we need to do what we can to keep jobs local. I am a second-generation title industry professional, and I have a daughter working in my office who is third generation. Alaska Escrow employs 14 full-time people and 2 part-time positions, all local, all Southeast, and I believe it's best to keep it this way for our communities. I currently have an employee who works for a company in Washington State. When she started, they had 7 examiners. After 2 years, they were all laid off but one due to outsourcing and overseas. I really don't want to see this happen for our state. Also, Section 3, because it's best for a consumer. Without it, developers can add additional funds to each transaction every time a property changes hands. Overall, the whole bill helps to protect property owners in the state of Alaska. Thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Any questions for Ms. Gleason? Thanks again for joining us today. Chris Newbill, also Ketchikan, different firm.
Yeah, this is Chris Newbill from the manager at Ketchikan Title Agency. And I just, I didn't have anything prepared, but I am in agreement with the bill and with both what Roger and Kim have stated. I only have 3 employees, but we all are residents of Ketchikan and residents of the state of Alaska, and I would really hate to see the jobs go overseas. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Crystal Altola?
Yes, I'm here. Chairman, can you hear me?
Yeah, please state your name and affiliation for the record, and thank you for joining us.
My name is Crystal Peltola. I'm with Alaska USA Title Agency. I am the Vice President and General Manager. I began the company in January of 2008. We now have five branches throughout the state, and I have been doing title since 1982. We have always supported the transfer fee portion of Senate Bill 122, which is currently Section 3, and I'd like to take a moment to thank the Realtor Association for their likewise support of that section. We have also continued to support legal competition and remain a pro-consumer company. This bill has gone through several changes since it was introduced at the end of last year's session. Currently, the only item left from the original version is the transfer fee section. Sections 1 and 2 are being represented as Alaska Hire, yet nothing within the current language does this. Section 2 appears to even be unconstitutional as outlined in the legislative attorney's opinion from Dennis Bailey, dated 3/15/12. We cannot support anything that could be deemed unconstitutional. Section 2 also seems to contradict itself. On the one hand, it states that you shall be licensed in the manner provided for in Section 2127, which has provisions for non-resident licensing as well as resident licensing. And in the next sentence, it states that you may not obtain a license unless you are a resident of the state. I don't think you're going to hear testimony from anybody here today that is against Alaska Hire or Local Hire, but the language that's laid out in here doesn't seem to do that. Section 1 would change the current law to require companies owned by national underwriters, such as Stewart Title and First American Title, to obtain their title work from agencies instead of doing the work themselves. Although the ownership of these two companies reside in Texas and California, respectively, their local offices, which both of those companies have several around the state, hire Alaskans and add to the economy of the state. One company's legal counsel has stated that they will modify their arrangements and become agencies if this bill passes as is. So as kind of to Roger's point, this isn't going to change any of the businesses or the way that they operate today, even though it appears to create another layer of paperwork for those direct operations. I personally do not see the value or consumer good that comes from creating this additional paperwork on some companies, nor do I see how it truly addresses the Alaska Hire. In conclusion, we remain supportive of Section 3. It's good public policy, but I cannot support Sections 1 and 2 at this time. Thank you.
And for the record, if the bill does move out of Labor and Commerce, it is going on to Judiciary, where it will get serious attention on a couple of the issues that you raised. Any questions for Crystal? Thanks again. I'm sorry you made the trip down last Friday and that we had communication problems.
That's all right. It was beautiful.
Yeah, but everything's working today. We did phone checks. Terry Bryant, Anchorage, First American Title. Are you with us, Terry?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Terry Bryant, Vice President, State Manager of First American Title Insurance Company. I currently have 75 employees throughout the state in 10 separate offices. First American Title Insurance Company has been very involved with the evolution of Senate Bill 122, and through that evolution and at current time, First American Title Insurance Company will be withdrawing its support for Senate Bill 122 and cannot support it at this time. That would be the end of my comments today. Thank you.
We take a question, Terry?
Yes.
Representative Sandler.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Bryan, I'm looking at your, so you're withdrawing your email from February 27th. Is your opposition to 1, 2, 3 sections altogether, or is there any gradations of support or of opposition to those different sections?
The primary support was initially was for a portion of the Senate bill that has been subsequently stripped, which was the plant, the years that a plant would need to be in existence, a title plant would need to be in existence. That was the primary area of support. When that was stripped, enthusiasm dropped to a certain degree, and the issue that's currently being discussed today, we currently have that under advisement and evaluating our position as it relates to Section 2, the Alaska Hire segment of the bill. So at current time, we're unable to support the bill in its current form.
I understand. So you oppose the current one, Section 1, 2, and 3, I understand.
So that's the outsourcing?
Yes.
Are you currently doing any outsourcing?
Currently in the state of Alaska, First American Title does not do any outsourcing at all.
So if you could at some point in time in the future, depending on what happens with this legislation.
As most companies would be able to have the capability, yes, First American Title would have the capability to do that along with other companies within the state.
Any further questions? Representative Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm going to ask a question that I'm not expecting anybody has the quantification research on, but do you know, you know, if there are 100 title searches done in Alaska per year, how many of those are actually being done outside? Is there any research or any kind of numbers that we know of yet?
Again, this is Terry Bryan with First American Title. I would anticipate approximately 99 plus of the 100 will be done in-state.
Thank you.
Any further questions? Thanks again. Howard Hancock, Anchorage Fidelity Title.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, thank you. My name is Howard Hancock. I'm the Chief Title Officer with Fidelity Title Agency of Alaska here in Anchorage. I've been in business for over 30 years now, and I'm also a board member of the Alaska Land Title Association. I'm here in support of this bill. Currently, as noted on the Division of Insurance's own website, their practices to grant a license to individual residents only. This applies to all employed title examiners in approximately 30 offices around the state. Nonetheless, there's a provision that we've seen in the existing insurance code that could allow the division to grant a non-resident license. So this is just merely a correction of that conflicting provision. In recent years, we have seen an increase, and as recently as last month, I would say probably on a monthly basis, I get a solicitation from somebody in the Philippines or Bangladesh asking us if we would like to have them perform a title search from them. We've also seen other title companies in other states around the country doing title examinations. We even went to the point of doing a test, if you will, of one of these outside outfits from India, and took them up on their offer and asked if they would do a search, and we gave them a property here in Anchorage to examine title to. They told us they would turn the report around within about 4 days. After about a week, we didn't hear anything. We went back to them. They said they were having difficulties with retrieving and interpreting the documents for the chain of title. We gave them a couple more days. They still couldn't produce the report. End game, they basically came back and canceled our request because they were not able to do the job. My point here is that, you know, laws with respect to titles on real property are unique to the state where the property is located. So as such, you know, if you were buying a home, you know, if you're a home buyer or mortgage lender, which is probably the largest consumer of our products, you know, wouldn't you want your title examined by a local expert trained in our local Alaska laws and title issues? You know, such unique laws, you know, and issues include things like the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act, the Native Allotment Act, mechanics lien law, foreclosure laws, public land order highways, state of Alaska section line easements, things of this nature that we encounter here in Alaska as title examiners on a day-to-day basis. So, again, in conclusion, we're just doing this as a correction to give guidance to the division in light of their existing practices as it is, and keeping jobs local, and have local resident title examiners take care of your title for you. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? Seeing none, I think we're down to the last one. Michael Price, are you with us?
Michael Price.
Please state your affiliation for the record.
I am the current president of the Alaska Land Title Association, and I am the owner of Fidelity Title Agency of Alaska in Anchorage and Matsu Title Insurance Company Matsu Title Insurance Agency in Wasilla, Alaska.
Thank you for joining us today. Please continue.
I am obviously in support of Senate Bill 122's passage as it currently reads. I support everything that most people have indicated in support of this bill. We have about 80 to 100 Alaskans employed around the state as title examiners, earning between $50,000 and $100,000 a year. And in my opinion, if we do not pass this law, those jobs are in jeopardy. First American, Terry Bryan is my good friend. First American, is my understanding, outsources, not in the state of Alaska, but in other states. And we believe that if we do not pass a local hire type law, it is only a matter of time when those jobs leave the state to go overseas. As far as the testimony goes regarding First American and Stewart Title or other direct operations, I hope Linda Hall is online, and I think she can confirm that there is nothing in these two sections of the bill which would preclude a direct underwriter from entering business in the state of Alaska, number one. Number two, First American and Stewart Title, as they currently exist in the state of Alaska, already exist as local limited producers, Alaskan corporations. They don't do business, my understanding, as the national underwriter out of Houston or Santa Ana, California. They do business as Alaskans corporations. And lastly, if, you know, as to the constitutionality, I've been an attorney for 40 years before I sort of retired and started running title companies. I do believe in the constitutionality of this local hire bill. Approximately 13 states have now passed legislation demanding that the licensed title examiners for title insurance be residents of the state in which the property is insured. The state of Oregon was the last state to do so about 2 years ago. And you can compare the state of Oregon to what Kim testified to with the state of Washington, who does not have such a law, where it is just it's just too easy to outsource or to consider outsourcing these types of jobs. And so on behalf of as president of the Alaska Land Title Association and as owner of the two companies in the state, I fully support and would urge you to pass Senate Bill 122 for the protection of Alaskan jobs. Thank you.
Any questions for Mr. Price? Mr. Vice Chair.
Thank you. Ms. Price, can you tell me the difference in the cost of title insurance in Washington and Oregon?
Specifically, no. I mean, each state, as in Alaska, files its rates with the Division of Insurance, and every state in the Western United States, most of the states in the Western United States are filed rates, just like Alaska's a filed rate. Some states are promulgated by the Director of Insurance. But it's my understanding that title insurance in the state of Washington is less than the state of Oregon, but comparable to Alaska. And both states are somewhat comparable to Alaska. Alaska has laws that are somewhat unique and risks that are unique to it through the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act and the laws that, you know, sort of have passed and overseeded with public land orders and things like that. But I would say that, generally speaking, title insurance in the Western United States are filed rates, and those rates, by the way, are not filed by us local companies. They're filed by the national companies. And so their rates are set by the First Americans and the Stewarts and the Fidelity National companies, not us local agents. I don't know if that answered your question. But as far as the rates themselves, those are obviously filed rates approved by the various directors of insurance and are available to you through your staff just searching on the Internet.
Follow up? I think I'm not sure follow, but I guess a statement as much. If this money is going to be outsourced and goes right to the bottom line of a company, that's one thing. But if it is actually results in a product that costs less for the consumer, then I have a little different issue. So I just
I don't think there is any empirical evidence that if an underwriter in the state of Washington sends an order to Bangladesh and gets it examined by somebody earning 35 cents an hour, that they have reduced the cost of the insurance pro-rata-ly. Most of the cost of the insurance is based upon the overhead, the administrative, and the claims handling. And so, again, I do not believe that you will see anywhere in the United States where, in those states that do not prohibit outsourcing to anywhere in the world, I do not believe that you will ever see evidence that the cost of the insurance has gone down either at all or dramatically. Those rates have basically, like the state of Alaska's general rate schedule has not changed since 1968.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Any further questions? Thanks again. Anybody else online? Nope. And nobody in the room? With that, we'll close up public testimony, and I'd like to ask Linda Hall from the Division of Insurance to come up briefly.
Thought she was going to get away with it, didn't she?
She knows better.
She tried to hide in the back.
I know. Did you win?
Yeah.
The individual wouldn't take it.
Smart.
I would have. For the record, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Linda Hall, Director of the Division of Insurance.
I guess my first question is, can you give us a brief summary of what your responsibilities are to the title insurance industry at this point in time?
Mr. Chairman, we regulate various aspects of the title insurance industry, and I guess I'll start with the issue that Mr. Price just raised regarding rates. You have to be clearly understand we have insurance companies in the title world as we do in other lines of insurance, and we have agencies. So there are two different types of licenses. The companies are not Alaskan companies. There's no Alaskan domiciled insurance company. They may be in Texas or wherever. And we license those in the same way we license insurance, any other type of insurance company. There's application processes and deposits and surplus, et cetera.
So they would be admitted companies?
They would be admitted companies. The company files the rates for the product that is sold by the agent. Much of that product is based, as was indicated, on overhead. It's much more difficult for us to actually look at specific information because the overhead, the majority of the employees doing the title research, the cost of running an office, the cost of keeping a paper plan or doing electronic research, whatever they do, is the bigger part of the rate. And that is not an expense of the insurance company. Loss ratios in the title insurance world are very low. So we're with most lines of insurance that we regulate rates, we are looking at historical losses and what it costs, what they pay out, as well as then a much smaller piece of overhead and a commission. The title world is different. So the title insurance company gets a small portion of the premium. The title agent, on the other hand, who is called the limited, I'm not sure I can say it right, limited lines title producer, that is the agency. They keep a majority of the premium because they're doing the majority of the work. They have the overhead. So if that overhead was less expensive because you outsourced it somewhere, that isn't really going to affect the rate that's filed by the title insurance company. Does that help?
That helps. How about licensing?
I referenced the licensure of the insurance company. The agency is also licensed. We license title plants. Two or more entities can form together and have a joint title plant. We license those. We go out and we inspect them. We give them a test in much the same way you heard described as someone tested a license examination in India. We will give them a piece of property to see how well they can research and find anything that might be wrong with that title that would prevent there from being a clear title that they can insure. We license the limited title producers as agents. They are licensed under a different section than the insurance company. And the title, there's a specific title chapter in Title 21 insurance statutes that has some specific requirements for title agents. And one of those is that they have to have a place of business in the recording district where they're going to operate. Doesn't say currently that they have to be a resident, but they at least have to have a place of business. So we have agents and we have insurance companies, and they are licensed differently.
Anybody else got a question for Linda? Representative Sadler.
Thank you. Through the chair, Linda, on page 2 of this bill, section 2 makes reference to, well, the title of the section says title insurance limited producers to be licensed. And shall be licensed. My question is this: is there any substantial difference in the term? And on the first page, it's a licensed title insurance limited producer, and the second page, it's title insurance limited producers to be licensed. Is there any distinction here? Is it just a purely grammatical artifact of the bill drafting?
In section 1, the licensed title insurance limited producer is not required to be a resident. They're required to be licensed under AS 2127. I believe I've stated, to the best of our knowledge, we have never issued a non-resident. That would be to another state, someone who is a resident of another state. But I don't believe that we have ever licensed a non-resident before. That is not to say we couldn't. Under some of the reciprocity laws, some of them don't apply to title insurance specifically, but if a title agent was licensed in another state and applied for a non-resident license here, it is a possibility, not likely, but it is. They would still have to have a place of business.
Follow?
And actually, the 27 does... Title 2127 does include a provision for an alien license. Have you ever known the state to issue an alien license?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, not in the title industry. We have issued alien licenses. In fact, I had a report run on that last week on that very question, and I think we have 6 alien licenses, so it's not something out of 39,000. That's not something we do routinely.
Is this something you used to do routinely that are still hanging?
Mr. Chairman, no. It's not something we've ever done routinely.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Johnson.
Linda, if we pass this, are we going to drive up the cost of insurance?
Through the chair, Representative Johnson, I don't know why you would drive the cost of insurance. I mean, I certainly have a fiscal note attached to the bill that's zero. Right. Doesn't change my role. Will it change the expenses? The rates that are enforced today should represent the expenses today. I don't see anything in this bill that would increase expenses.
Follow up. If we don't pass it, are we going to drive down the cost?
Through the chair, Representative Johnson, I doubt it.
Good enough.
Sounds like a wash.
Yeah. No, it's. And Mr. Chairman, if I might, I'm just, you know, the consumer is the ultimate payer of this, and you know, I think our obligation not only to look after the business owners, but the consumer as well. And I'm not saying if because I take it as the gospel when Linda says it. I have no problem with this.
I think Ms. Hall will probably agree with, well, I hate putting words in her mouth, is it safe to assume that one of the reasons we don't have many issues on title policies is there's no frequency of claims against title policies?
Mr. Chairman, that would be accurate.
I mean, from my personal experience, I can only think of one in my community in the 30 years I've lived down there, and it was due to a surveying error where a house was built on somebody else's lot, but and it ultimately went against the title policy. Mm-hmm. But that's the only one I can think of. I mean, you just don't see them.
Yeah.
Representative Sadler.
Thank you, the Chair. Ms. Hall, Ms. Peltola did say that she thought Section 2 might be self-contradictory. And, of course, now I've lost the sheet here. Because it says that the bill before us says that owner producer may not obtain a license unless they're a resident. However, 2127 does allow for aliens or non-resident licenses. Do you see an inherent contradiction or a fatal contradiction?
Now, through the chair, Representative Sadler, that's probably a legal question that I'm not qualified to answer.
Okay.
Might be one for the next committee.
Fair enough.
Any further questions for Ms. Hall? Thanks again for putting up with us.
Thank you.
Let's see. We closed out public testimony. We brought it back to the committee. What are the wishes of the committee?
Mr. Chairman, I would move the CS for Senate Bill 122, designated 27LSO789-D, out of committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes, if any.
Seeing no opposition, the bill will move on to judiciary, where we can examine the outstanding issues. And with that, we'll take a brief at ease. To Chris. We were awaiting the final documentation on 266. I believe you were informed of that before the meeting, but we will be hearing it hopefully either tomorrow or Wednesday, depending on how fast we get the final CS in. So that clears up 266. And the final bill on the calendar today is
51.
SB 51, state vending licenses. And I believe we have Tom Obermeyer, there he is, couldn't see him behind the chair.
Hi.
From Senator Davis's office. Welcome back, Tom, and please state your name and affiliation for the record and walk us through.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Tom Obermeyer, aide to Senator Davis. The bill before you is Senate Bill 51. You currently have a committee substitute version I. 27LS0071-I as an indigo. The explanation of changes for the committee substitute is that originally we had tried to ask that we insert additional properties available to the blind in the bill by changing the definition of property to include school property and municipal properties so that vending facilities would be available to more people. It was determined after discussion with schools and other municipal entities that this was not going to be feasible, at least in the short run, and so we made a committee substitute to pull that language out, and that is, in fact, what you're looking at in version I. So we're now down to the original 12 properties, 6 federal, 6 state. Federal under the Randolph-Shepard Act, the 6 state are under what they call the Chance Act in Alaska. And if you would indulge me, I would like to read the initial sponsor statement and then be happy to answer any questions. Senate Bill 51 restores to blind persons first priority for a contract to operate a vending facility on state and other public property. It's primarily just state and federal property. This bill amends the Alaska Chance Act of 1976 to require that the State Division of Vocational Rehabilitation Business Enterprise Program provide the same first priority to the blind on state property as it does on federal property, enforced under the Randolph-Shepard Act of 1936. The Alaska Chance Act, for the first time, added disabled persons in addition to the blind in preference for vending licenses on public facilities. I believe this occurred in about 1982. I'd have to go back and look at the dates on it. This loss of first priority and expansion of beneficiaries has thwarted the spirit and letter of the Randolph Shepherd Act. The resulting decrease in vending opportunities for blind merchants in Alaska is exacerbated by their already extraordinarily high unemployment rates among all types and severities of the disabled and the population in general. And I think if you saw the detailed documentation, you would find that there is about a 70% unemployment rate among the blind. And it's
Tom, I'd like to interrupt. For the record, we've been joined by Senator Davis. And welcome back. Please continue.
And the it's not determined at maybe the department can help you as to the exact number of blind in the state. I've been told it's as high as 12,000. There might be 9.3 million visually impaired in this country. The I noticed that in looking at the question that the recent census report went out, it asked families if they had disabled and or blind in the family. It doesn't, that count would not give you an accurate number. I'm not too sure how they do the count. Senate Bill 51 recognizes that the blind are dissimilarly situated compared to other disabled persons who do not suffer the same degree of impairment and unemployment as an economic matter. That's a very important comment because there was a question about equal protection between the various disabled. Although the state has combined management and training opportunities for both the blind and other persons with disabilities under one business enterprise program of the Division of Vocational Rehabilitation, this bill requires that it must give first priority to the blind for vending contracts on state and federal property. SB 51 comports with the original legislative intent and gives first priority to the blind under Alaska Statute 2315.100 prior to changes in 1974 and 2006, which added persons with disabilities and severe disabilities who currently compete for the blind for licenses on vending facilities on this property, public property. It requires that the division attempt to find and notify blind persons of vending opportunities as they arise on public property. These public properties may include, among others, courthouses, military bases, state and federal office buildings, and other public properties. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them. I would point out that, if nothing else, this bill shows with probably the greatest interest on all part that there are very few opportunities for either the blind or the disabled under these facility acts in the state. There are only 12. There's six state, six federal. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Representative Sadler?
Well, maybe to the punch, but Mr. Chairman, Mr. Obermeyer, you said you estimated about 12,000 blind or vision, is it blind or vision impaired or combination? Or
through the chair, Representative Sadler, I assume that it's visually impaired because there are different levels of impairment that I've discovered throughout the state just working on this bill.
Okay, and what about the numbers of severely disabled? Any estimate of those?
I'm sorry, I don't have those numbers. I think the department is here and they could probably answer that better than I could.
Okay. And under this bill, would the severely disabled be barred from getting, they wouldn't have the first priority, would they be barred from getting contracts at all?
Through the chair, it would be my understanding that they would not be barred. I think the business enterprise program was designed specifically to assist, and I think there are procedures in place where they might be able to provide at least temporarily positions for others to take the place of a blind person if they could not find a blind person, and that might turn into a long-term contract, I assume, if no blind person is either trained or available. And training is a very important part of this process as well.
So you're saying that the severely disabled might be able to take up the jobs at the
point we're not available? That's my understanding. The department might be able to clarify that a little better than I would. And we also, I believe, I had asked that that the drafter be online. You might be able to ask that question if it's in the specific language here. I'd have to go back through the process, but.
I did one last answer. Oh, go ahead.
Yeah, we'll be getting to Terry in a few minutes.
But I have one more question for the sponsor's representative. And last question, I guess, at this point would be, would this bill require the severely disabled to give up contracts? What would be the impact on those? Who
Through the chair, Representative Sagler, it's my understanding that everyone that has existing contracts will be grandfathered into this process. And they have, these are all long-term contracts. For the most part, as I understand, these are what they would call licenses, and they are indefinite in duration. So I don't see where there's any threat to the existing holders of these licenses. I would also note that in the sectional that was drafted on February 13th, it indicates under Section 3 that Section 2315.133 allows the agency to contract persons who are not blind, and when there is under subsection D, when there's a vacancy, they will attempt to contact blind persons. And also, I think the drafter might be able to indicate if there's any prohibition from their taking other people, not only disabled, but others, if they're in a very remote location that can't handle this. And I would give you an example. I think that there was, I think, a facility down in Kodiak or one of the other locations where they could not get the person trained to take the facility.
Paul?
And last question, I guess really the last question. If there are not people with visual impairment or blind people available to get the contract, they would have first priority for, would there be any provision to allow other people to contract this out or hire the people to take the contracts on behalf of a blind person?
Through the chair, yes, I assume that this is possible. I think it's. I think in some cases it's almost imperative. You have a very large facility, for example, a cafeteria, something that requires additional people. They're going to have to hire others to help them, whether they're in the first management position or as a subordinate.
Okay. So this is not just to operate facilities, but to have a contract to operate.
And I think the department can answer that as well. There was some question about the word contract in the language that we had. And it was my understanding that they usually use a contract on a temporary basis to try to place people. But then in my further inquiry, I discovered that they have what they call operating agreements / contracts, even in the long-term licenses. And they can better answer that question than I could.
Tom, can you walk us through the sectional real quick?
Yes, sir. The sectional on version I, section 1 amends the section dealing with powers and duties of the Division of Vocational Rehabilitation, removes references to persons with severe disabilities from the provisions dealing with the operation of vending facilities on public property. It directs the agency to issue a license for the operation of vending facilities on public property under Section 2 to blind persons who meet certain criteria, including criteria established by agency regulations. It requires these regulations to provide blind persons with first priority for a contract to operate the vending facility. Subsection 3 adds additional sections on the issuance of licenses for vending facilities on public property. And as I explained earlier, 2315.133C allows the agency to contract with a person who's not blind to operate the facility until the agency can locate a blind person who qualifies to operate the vending facility. Subsection 2315.133D is in David, when there is a vacancy in the operation of a vending facility on state property, it requires the agency to attempt to contract blind persons directly about operating the facility. Directs the agency to work with private organizations to contact blind persons. This requirement is in addition to any other procurement requirements under Alaska Statute 36.30, the State Procurement Code. Newspaper advertising is not sufficient. Subsection 2315.133E, as an echo, allows a blind person operating a vending facility to operate another vending facility if the agency cannot find a blind person to operate the other vending facility. So it would allow, in this circumstance, what they would call a multiple location, or a multiple vending contract. for an individual. Subsection 4 deletes reference to persons with severe disabilities and provision relating to hearings on agency actions. 5, subsection 5 amends the definition of licensee to remove the reference to a person with a severe disability. 6, repeals the section relating to vending facilities operated by persons with severe disabilities. 7, indicates that the Act applies to vending facility licenses issued and vending facility contracts entered into on or after the effective date of this Act. And 8 states that the Act does not affect a contract entered into before the effective date of this Act. So that answers directly the question about grandfathering in the existing licensees.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I heard in there a lot of additional work for the department. They've got to go out and seek. They can't just run newspaper ads. They can't have, it's not the regular notice process. I don't know how that cannot have a physical note.
Through the chair, I think the department's going to have to better answer that.
Okay. Senator Davis, you here to add anything?
I don't care to add anything. I think he's done a very good job of explaining this bill to you. I'm just pleased that you did bring it up, and I thank you for that.
Oh.
And by the way, I'm
our pleasure.
Senator Betty Davis. And I
oh, it doesn't mean I don't think I'd call you on that one. Well, at this point in time, we have a number of people that signed up in the room. Now, having said that, somebody walked off with her sign-up sheet. So what I'm showing from what has been reconstructed is we have Lauren Kempton. Is Lauren in the room? Please join us and please state your name and affiliation for the record.
My name is Lauren Kempton. I am the project manager for Inspirational Action Incorporated. What we do, we're a nonprofit, and we work with DVR and other facilities and other programs to get disabled people into these contracts specifically. They come in with me. I train them to do exactly what it is that this bill is saying. So where our concern lies is that by taking out these parts that are geared towards the disabled people, what are we doing? What is the point of our program? We're not asking to get priority over the blind. That's not our intention. What we want is to not lose the little bit that we do have in there. I've seen young men and women come in that couldn't even look me in the eye and tell me their name. And by the time we're done, a lot of them could very well take these contracts and provide a living for themselves instead of drawing welfare, drawing SSI, becoming homeless. We see a lot of that. Just here in Juneau, of the homeless population, 65% have a mental disability or physical disability of some kind, preventing them from being comfortable working. We try to help with that. Thank you.
Any questions? Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for what you do. Do you think this will hinder your ability to get these contracts if you're given a second priority in terms of, I mean, pure numbers? Do you think?
Well, we're already given second priority. That's not the issue. We're still able to reach out, and we're still able to get people in and help them out. That's not the issue at all. We don't want to be moved up so much as we just don't want to lose what little bit we do have.
Thank you.
No. Thanks again. Sherilyn Morrow.
Chairman, my name is Sherilyn Morrow. I am an assistant manager at Inspirational Actions, and I have had the pleasure to work with DVR employees that come in for training, and I think what we do is important. I also understand the point of giving priority to the blind. I agree with Lauren. I don't believe that they should take what we do have. I have worked with a couple of people that were brought in, and I have learned as much from them as they have learned from me.
Any questions? Thanks again for joining us today. Guy James. And welcome to the committee, and please state your name for the record and your affiliation.
I'm Guy James, and employee of Inspirational Action, got the job through DBR.
Any questions for Guy?
That's okay.
Take your time.
First time's the toughest.
Yeah, it is.
Gets easier after that.
We're friendly.
Representative Miller?
Yes, thank you. Thanks for showing up, and we really do appreciate the work you folks do. How long have you been part of the program?
I've been part of the team since October.
So you just started. Let me make sure that I understand, because some of this distinction is a little fuzzy to me. Right now, without this bill, there's more of an equal footing between the folks that you generally deal with in your program, and this would simply take one section, one type of job, one type of occupation or business, and give a priority to those who are visually impaired. Is that the way I understand it?
The way that I read the bill when I was going through it, the verbiage in it, it already gave priority to the blind, mm-hmm. with a secondary to disabled persons. And when I looked over it, it just took out any section that said disabled persons.
Okay. Follow up, Mr. Chairman?
Certainly.
Can you give me a rough idea of what types of disabilities you're dealing with in a broad spectrum?
We work with just about any kind, as long as it's deemed safe to be in a food operation. Mainly what I've gotten in my time has been a mild mental disability, but we can work with physical also.
Thank you very much.
Representative Holmes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Guy, what do you do in your job? First of all, do you like your job?
Yes, I do.
That's great. So you've been there since October, so you've got a few months. You've been there maybe 6 months. So what do you do when you're there?
Yeah, I'm backup cook and also run the register as there for the team.
Okay, and they trained you how to do this?
Yes.
Yeah, and you're having a good time with it?
Yeah, I do.
Great. Well, thanks for showing up today. Appreciate it.
Thanks again.
Great job. Thanks.
Cheryl Walsh. Welcome back. Been a while. Please state your name and affiliation for the record.
I am Cheryl Walsh. I'm the director of the Division of Vocational Rehabilitation, and that's part of the Department of Labor and Workforce Development, and I'm the director of the program. And today I wanted to come testify to talk a little bit about some of the current concerns that we have as a division with the current legislation. I wanted to clarify that there are 13, we call them BEP sites, business enterprise sites, within the state of Alaska, and there's one currently in Juneau, and that's at the state office building. The bill directs the division to work with a private organization that specializes in employment of blind people to contact them about BEP openings. It's unclear what private organization in Alaska specializes in the employment of blind individuals. And so it's difficult for us to determine what kind of cost might be associated with that because we're not sure what organization that it's unidentified in the bill. And currently we believe that we are the organization that specializes in the plan with people who are blind. It's also unclear whether the passage of this legislation would allow us to combine the two programs that we currently have. We have a separate program for our federal sites and another program for the state sites. And that is necessary because we do include people with significant or severe disabilities in the state sites. And so we can't use federal dollars on those state sites. So we're not certain if we could combine the two programs because we have an individual with a severe disability currently on a state site, and he has an indefinite license to that site, so he would be grandfathered into the program. So I'm not certain if we can divide the two, if we can combine the programs. And if we are able to, we're not certain what the mechanism is to continue funding for his position or for the benefits that are associated with it. And since licenses are granted for an indefinite period of time, we're not certain, you know, if this individual would choose to retire into the future, you know, at what age that would be. We can only remove a person if they terminate voluntarily or if we have cause. And those are defined in regulation, what the causes are for non-performance. Other concerns that we have is the bill is unclear whether it is establishing first priority for blind persons for all BEP contracts, or if it's, because applying it to the temporary contracts is going to impede the division's ability to manage the program. We issue temporary contracts to industry or subject matter experts occasionally, especially if we need to do a feasibility on a site to make sure that it can have a fair rate of return for the individual who will be operating it, or if we need to establish the site as possibly a training site. And we might bring in, say, an industry expert who's skilled at the coffee carts or some of the other programs. They can do the training for us. We're concerned that a blind person may not have the expertise to meet those business or programmatic needs of these temporary contracts. We believe that the first priority should pertain only to the permanent assignment or licensing of a vending facility, not these temporary contracts. The bill would allow a blind individual to operate another facility, even if they already are permanently assigned to a facility, if we are unable to locate an individual. Because blindness is a low incidence condition or a disability, it can occur that we have an opportunity to open a new site or we have a vacancy at a site at a time when we don't have a current a trained blind individual to immediately assume that contract or that facility. So the bill is unclear about how long we would keep that open until we could offer it to a currently licensed vendor. And by offering it to a currently licensed vendor, we lock that site up permanently. We fear that this, because this is unclear, we think that this might be a source of future lawsuits. It's also unclear how many sites a currently licensed individual would be allowed to have because people move up within the system based on seniority and experience. They could potentially take over multiple sites, and over their lifetime, they would really diminish the number of sites that are available to new people entering the program, or for transfer and promotion opportunities for other people who are currently in the program. So I'm available if you have any questions.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. What happened to our coffee cart up here? I'm dating myself a little bit.
No, across the street.
No, there was one right up here in the entryway.
I'm not certain if that was a BEP site.
Mm-hmm. I think so.
I would have to research that because it was before my time as director.
Okay. And another follow-up. You'd said you're going to have to do more outreach and you're not sure you could do it. There's going to be cost to that, isn't there?
Well, we're not certain who that outreach is to, and we are unclear what the need for it is because currently all the individuals who are in the program are certified by our organization. They apply with our client services program, and then they identify a goal to become a dining facility manager or a snack bar manager, and then we write a vocational plan for them. So they come to us, so we are aware of all the certified managers, and we have a committee of blind vendors who we work through, and they represent all of the current vendors that we have in the program. And if someone moved to Alaska from out of state and they were certified in another state, I am certain that they would contact us and speak with us about participating.
Representative Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you for your testimony today and for the work you do. You mentioned training. Roughly how long does that take? And we are speaking specifically with a blind person to train them for this type of business.
I believe it's a six-month program. There is some testing that is involved in it, and they often are job shadowing on another site. Annually, we provide a stipend, or I believe it's $500 training stipend for continuing education. And then there's an annual Committee of Blind Vendors meeting where there's also training that's provided by different industry experts. Last year I went to one and they were showcasing a variety of foods that a vendor might, suggestions that they might want to add to their menus in their facilities.
Okay, follow up?
Certainly.
Thank you. And can you give me a rough guesstimation? Again, I'm not looking for absolutely solid ratios here. You talk about your division that you're dealing with disabled and with blind folks, roughly how many is the total? What's the community of visually impaired to all other divisions that you've got?
I don't have that breakdown, but I could give you an example of I have a chart here that says we placed 29 individuals who were blind in other occupations other than our BEP sites within the last 2 years. And then we have these 13 facilities, 10 of which are currently operated by blind individuals. It is a much lower incidence population. We had, I think, 2,500 cases that we were currently working with last year with people with disabilities, and it's probably less than 5% would be blind.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Any further questions? Thanks again.
Thank you.
Is there anybody else in the room that would care to testify? Seeing none, we've got a number of people online, including Terry Bannister, for questions. Anybody have any questions for Terry?
Not right now.
I think she's still online, but thanks for being there, Terry, in case we need you. With that, I think I'll go to Rick Renault in Anchorage. Are you with us?
Yes, I am.
Please state your name and affiliation for the record, and I heard you might have been one of the people on Friday that weren't able to get to.
Yes. My name is Rick Renault, and I'm the CEO of Kentucky North Incorporated, and I'm also the CEO for Inspirational Action, which is a 501c3 nonprofit organization, and I'm also a BEP vendor.
Please continue.
Okay. Well, as I was saying, I'm the CEO of Pentagon North and also Inspirational Action, both which provide food services to state and federal facilities and training and employment opportunities to people with disabilities. And I'm here today regarding the Senate Bill 51, of which a sponsor statement supported by Senator Betty Davis indicating that there is a loss of employment and priority for persons with blindness to hold contracts to operate vending facilities on state and other public properties. I want to refute this document on the basis that people like me with severe disabilities are involved in the decrease of vending and employment opportunities on state and public properties, including two, but not limited to, courthouses, military bases, and office buildings for blind persons. Disabled peoples who support absence in this bill will make a difference in the employment of the blind. To begin, I would like to discredit the first sentence of the sponsor statement, which declares that SB 51 restores blind persons' first priority for a contract to operate a vending facility on a state level. It is impossible to restore what was never taken away in the first place. The Alaska Chance Act of 1976 and its related programs has had clear clauses regarding first priority for the blind, which still hold true according to sections AS 23.15.210 and the testimony also of Mrs. Welsh, Director of Vocational Rehabilitation and the Business Enterprise Program. Nowhere in this act did it state that blind did not have priority for vending contracts. Furthermore, I want to argue the implications that the inclusion of people with severe disabilities in the Chance Act has been hindered the opportunity to gain vending contracts or employment for the blind. The Blind Vendors Committee removed three federal facilities from their program. And there are also two other state facilities that have remained vacant for over 2 years because there has been no success in finding qualified blind merchants to occupy these spaces. It is not that there is a lack of opportunities because there have been taken over by vendors with other disabilities. It's because blind vendors and associated programs have been giving up these opportunities and have not been taking advantage of the availability of these opportunities. The lack of employment among the blind has little to do with the disabled and more to do with the blind vendors and their associated programs. This leads me to the next point. If there is a real difference in employment rates and opportunities wants to be seen, more needs to be done from within. There is indeed a problem of extreme high unemployment rates among persons that are blind. According to a report on federal programs for unemployment of persons with disabilities, out of 2,681 licensed BEP vendors in the year 2004, they have hired only 337 blind workers, and even less workers with disabilities. However, the number of workers they hired with no disabilities whatsoever was a staggering 6,607. Therefore, in order to create more employment opportunities, blind vendors and programs need to hire and train more people who are blind. To conclude, I want to point out that the problem is not expanding opportunities for employment of vending locations for the blind by taking away the opportunities made available to the severely disabled in the Alaska Chance Act. The problem is finding trained, experienced blind vendors who are willing to take these contracts and fill these positions. If there are others, mainly people with other types of disabilities, with qualifications, it shouldn't be the fault of the people with disabilities. The liability should be on the programs to train and prepare the persons that are blind for these positions. And thank you for your time, and I'm more than happy to entertain any questions that you folks might have of me.
Well, thank you, Mr. Renaud. Any questions? Carol Renaud, we've got three other people that have signed up to testify. Could you be relatively brief in your comments? I'm sure they're probably similar to Rick's, but thank you for joining us today, and please state your name and affiliation for the record.
My name is Carol Renaud, and I'm a person with a severe disability, and if you take away this program later on when I might need to use this program, it won't be here, and I might be forced to go on welfare and apply for Social Security and other benefits, when right now I can work part-time. Thank you for letting me participate.
Well, thank you. Thank you again for joining us. Any questions for Mrs. Renaud? Thanks again. Lynn Correll, or Coral.
Hello, my name is Lynn Correll, and thanks to the chairman of the People in the Committee for holding this hearing. I think that...
Could you please state your name?
Let's say this. I've been blind all my life. Not every person has been. I've been blind all my life. I'm going to be 60 in June. I can tell you that employment of the blind has, even my parents didn't think a blind person could have certain jobs. When I was in junior high school, I was told that, well, you know, you better be nice to everybody because you're not going to be able to find a job when you grow up. This is not the sort of stuff that most other people with disabilities even hear. Blind people are seen as the most feared and abhorred disability in the United States, even including cancer and AIDS. I have two master's degrees. I have a lot of experience in web accessibility stuff and all sorts of issues, and I can tell you that people are not willing to see what our capabilities are as blind people. This program was established in 1936 because specifically blind people were not able to find employment. And the first person that I heard about who had a master's degree when I was about 16 years old committed suicide because he could not find a job. This is not a funny business about we're going to deny people jobs. People with disabilities. This program was set up by the federal government to help people who were blind attain a gainful employment. Blind people have, and disabled people have, higher rates of, we were called, I read in this book in the 1980s, that we were called the worthy poor. We know that this program has really provided a higher standard of living, and I know a lot of the people on the on the committee would understand when I say all we want is a chance, upward mobility. Blind people don't only have a disability that impacts their mobility, but their daily living and communication disability as well. Most disabilities don't have the trifecta issues that we have as blind people in terms of the issues of mobility, daily living, and communication. People have a hard time understanding that blind people can actually attain a job, use specified technology, but technology has not changed the attitudes of the public who don't understand and fear blind people. When we are told that blind people can't be trained well or we can't go train, many people in the vending program aren't even totally blind. Most of them are visually impaired, especially in the state of Alaska. So we have a real problem understanding and really feeling comfortable with working with blind people at all in most of the states in this country. And I remember when I was very young having us say that we should have a realistic goal. I'm not a vendor. I don't want to be a vendor. I never wanted to be a vendor. But I think the issues of depression that many blind people have, early death, suicide, trauma, because of basically the rates that we cannot even find a job, and so we have a lower standard of living, and we can't even, and a lot of drug abuse and alcohol and stuff like that, because we're not treated. We're treated very poorly and with a lot of stereotypes. And I've been told by, and I know other people have been told by rehabilitation counselors, that not only can't they start their own business, not vending, but their own business because they don't have the skills if you're totally blind, but they also can't have high paying, decent jobs, in nonprofits or other places that we should, that if I wasn't blind, I would be paid five times as much as I've ever been able to earn in my lifetime. I really think that, we have muddied the waters when we're talking about parity. This is not about giving equal treatment. This is a bill specifically in 1936 that gave blind people a lift up, a hand up, not a hand out. And what we need is to make sure that we do have the first priority that has not been adhered to, implemented by the Division of Vocational Rehabilitation in many cases. And I happen to have a degree in public administration and in social work, so I understand what it takes to get a bill passed and the political implications of a lot of these things. But when you consider that most people with other disabilities, and the last number I heard about the people with disabilities was in about 2001, about 29,981 people, that what we need is to understand that blind people, being a low incidence disability, need a lot of education. As for the nonprofit that would help with employment, the private organization, I would say, Ms. Walsh, that the Alaska Center for the Blind and Visually Impaired is at least as well equipped as the Division of Vocational Rehabilitation. You already work with them to help with certifying people and training people who are blind and visually impaired. So a lot of this is smoke and mirrors. A lot of this is confusing you, and I'm sorry to you great legislators, especially my friend Dan Savage, who I know is a great songwriter. But I think that seriously, we need to really get the facts on the table and stop muddying the waters and stop treating the blind as if we can't be trained.
Any questions for Ms. Corral? Thank you again for taking the time to join us today. Richard Gardenhire.
Thank you, Mr. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Richard Gardenhire. I'm the current president of Alaska Independent Blind, a consumer organization of blind and visually impaired people in the state of Alaska. And even though I didn't make, I don't have a prepared statement at this time, but I'm going to be very brief. I'm speaking in support of Senate Bill 51. Like Lynn, who spoke before me, I'm not a vendor either, but I am employable. Several years ago, I went to the Division of Voc Rehab to apply for a small business loan because I wanted to do something in the way of a small business venture. I had blueprints. I had revenues, projected revenues, and so on. I did all the legwork. And the counselor said, "Well, I'm sorry, but I don't know what we can do for you." As you can imagine, that's pretty discouraging when a DVR client, which I was at that time, goes in to apply for a small business loan so that he can provide for his family, only to be told that, "Well, I'm sorry, I don't know what else I can do for you, or I don't know what else I can help you with." And basically, I didn't necessarily need financial help in as much as I needed to buy and purchase some equipment that would be a benefit to me. But time after time, the Division of Vocational Rehabilitation has violated the state statute by not giving the blind person the priority to operate these stands, and consequently, now we're here to. I'm here in support of the bill because it will clarify and more define what first priority means. Thank you once again, members of the committee and Mr. Chairman, for allowing us to testify before the committee. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Mr. Swartz, for making the effort to join us today. Any questions for Mr. Swartz? With that, I'm going to hold.
I'm sorry.
Is there anybody else online?
Yes. I'm James Swartz.
Oh, I'm sorry. I was one line ahead of myself.
Mr. Gardenhire is the person that just got done speaking.
Yep. Please state your name and affiliation for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is James Swartz. I'm currently a licensed vendor in the Alaska Business Enterprise Program. I've also, from 92 to 95, I was the director. I worked for the Division of Vocational Rehabilitation as the director of this program. So I know this program from both sides. The Division of Vocational Rehabilitation trains and places hundreds of people every year in employment opportunities. This program is unique because it was developed specifically for the blind. It provides an employment opportunity, but it's more than that. I'm an entrepreneur, as all the vendors within this program are. We own our own businesses. I own Jimmy's Espresso Stand, located in the Alaska Native Medical Center here in Anchorage. I employ six people, two whom are blind and one who is deaf. In 2006, I applied for a vending stand in the courthouse. As being blind, I was supposed to have had first priority. I was denied that employment opportunity, and it was given to a non-blind person. That non-blind person today is the CEO of two different corporations, however, still retains that facility, denying a blind person of that employment opportunity when it's very clear that they do not. I'm here to urge you to pass this piece of legislation. It's not denying anyone an employment opportunity. It's just protecting the right of the blind and our first priority. Does anyone? And I also operated that coffee stand there in the Juneau Capitol building. If you want to talk to me about that,
I think we got one question for you.
Yeah, what happened to it? Why is it still not here?
Cheryl, you might want to cover your ears. This management from the Division of Vocational Rehabilitation. Oops. They did not place a qualified vendor in that facility.
Fair enough.
Any further questions? Mr. St. Holmes?
Nope. Mr. Chairman.
Thanks again for joining us today. And with that, I'm going to hold the public. We don't have anybody else online, do we? I'm going to hold the public testimony open and carry this bill over. We've got several more meetings. And thank you again for everybody that came today. And
Chairman, before you close out on this bill, could I make a statement?
Sure.
For some time,
please state your name and affiliation for the
Once again, I'm Senator Betty Davis. I'm from Anchorage, and I represent District K. That's east side of Anchorage. For some time, we've carried this bill, and I thought that there was a real need for this particular bill to come forward, and I still feel that there's some need for this bill to come forward. But in its present form, it's not ready to move any further. And we're at the end of the session here now, so even if you held this bill and brought it back in a day or so, it would not reach its mark. It's not ready. But I have learned a lot of things. I'm not backing off because I will fight an issue as long as I need to fight it if I feel the necessity to do that. But I see I need to back up and look at some other situations now. I'm concerned about what the division is doing now more than I am about this bill moving forward. And at some point, I'm going to request the audit of the division to deal with some of the issues that were brought up by some of the blind people and the way they have been treated or why they have not gotten these jobs and the training that they provide. I'm not saying that they're not doing their job, you know, well as they think they can, but there might be need for improvement. And so I'm withdrawing this bill, and I will not request another hearing on it at this time.
I would like to be on the record for commending you for bringing it forward in the first place. And I think it needs some work.
It is. It needs work, and we have time to do that, but not now.
I know how you feel. I've,
yeah. All right. We've all been there.
But again, I thank you.
Thank you.
And with that, we will adjourn. We will table the bill and adjourn at 5:10, and we're meeting tomorrow.
Yep. Tomorrow.
It should be noticed by now.